this week's programme, Julian Barnes's award-winning novel, The Sense of an Ending. This book explores the difficulties involved in reconstructing past events. It's notable that the theme of suicide is interrogated here more in terms of the light it throws on historical analysis than as a moral issue. There are three main characters. Two of them meet at grammar school, the narrator, Tony Webster, and Adrian Finn, the brightest boy in the class. Both in their college years become involved with the same woman, Veronica Ford. Tony is the first to do so. They meet at Bristol University. Then Adrian, who is now at Cambridge, enters the triangle. Out of the blue, he asks Tony's permission to date his girlfriend. Tony eventually loses her to Adrian, but 40 years later on, wonders whether he's experiencing a renewal of his earlier love for her. With me, Julia Carlson and Niall McMonagall. In this extract, Tony recalls the summer after his final university exams when his ex-girlfriend Veronica had taken up with his old school friend Adrian.
I stayed on for a few weeks after finishing my exams. Fell in with a different group, drank systematically, smoked a bit of dope, and thought about very little. Apart from imagining what Veronica might have said to Adrian about me. He took my virginity and then immediately dumped me, so really the whole thing felt like rape, do you see? I imagined her buttering him up. I'd witnessed the start of that. And flattering him, playing on his expectations. As I said, Adrian was not a worldly person for all his academic success. Hence the priggish tone of his letter, which for a while I used to reread with self-pitying frequency. When at last I replied to it properly, I didn't use any of that silly epistle language. As far as I remember, I told him pretty much what I thought of their joint moral scruples. I also advised him to be prudent, because in my opinion, Veronica had suffered damage a long way back. Then I wished him good luck, burnt his letter in an empty grate. Melodramatic, I agree, but I plead youth as a mitigating circumstance, and decided that the two of them were now out of my life forever.
Michael James Ford, reading from The Sense of an Ending by Julian Barnes. Niall McMonagall, what do you think of the novel?
It's a very accessible novel, and it's a nasty piece of work. I was surprised because the last book I'd read by Julian Barnes was the Dickensian Arthur and George, which looked at racism and justice. This is a much smaller book, it would seem, at first, but it needs to be read twice. And it's a very dull, plod, normal world in many levels. But what really interested me was the way the voice, the narrator, an unreliable narrator in many ways, or a self-deluded narrator, interrogates the idea of narrative, the idea of memory, the idea of language. So even though it's slight in terms of the book you hold in your hand, you get a very strong sense of a whole life being covered. And it is a man in his 60s looking back to when he was an adolescent through university. And, for example, he leaves out so much more. This could have been an 800-page book. And he just tells us, no, other people that he mentions in 2.5 sentences do not really enter the narrative. What he is trying to do is to try and make sense of something that was preposterous and poisonous and awful. And it links back to that extract we've just heard.
Yeah. The letter Julia Carlson.
Well, I think on one level it's quite a simple story, as Niall says, and about a man who's really very dull, who comes across in this kind of way, who describes himself as being peaceable, whose girlfriend describes him as being cowardly. He's dogged. And this man suddenly, by the end of the novel, and I won't give anything away, finds himself in the middle of what is almost a real kind of trick ending. And this trick ending transforms his whole life.
I think you're quite right, Niall. It's deliberately a short novel. It could have been much longer.
Yes, I mean, he marries, he divorces, and he's had his daughter in between times in 2.5 sentences. But what he's really focusing on is his inability to comprehend. There's a motif in the novel which Veronica keeps returning to. You just don't get it, do you, she says. And he doesn't get it. He doesn't have the nuance or understanding. I mean, he says at one stage, you know, that he is average. That's what I'd been ever since I left school. Average at university and work, average in friendship, loyalty and love. And he doesn't have that imaginative experience to go beyond it. Now, he always speaks of how he would like to live life as lived in the great literatures he has read, but that doesn't really work out either. He's a very banal character. He descales his kettle. He buys a string for the blind. It's a very credible voice in a way, and the voice is very casual. And as well, I mean, Barnes is a real intellectual, but he doesn't bring anything showy off to the narrative because he allows this banal voice to become the total experience of the book.
How did you find the handling of the sixth form, the high school scene? How did you find that, Julia?
Of the kind of experience of adolescence. Mm. Yeah, I thought that was quite evocative, actually.
Yeah,
it takes up about the first third of the book. It's identified as part one, where they're described as being book hungry, sex hungry, meritocratic and anarchistic.
Adrian Finn is a very precocious grammar school student, you know, with a highly sophisticated grasp of historiography and so on. I mean, he seemed extraordinary. But then that was the point of the story.
Well, I think that, yes, I mean, he's an idea. He's not a character. Mm. He's a catalyst for what's to come. And he has kind of the ideas that are developed in a sense most fully in the novel. For example, he has this idea of history and that history occurs at the point where the imperfections of memory meet the inadequacies of documentation.
I mean, the likelihood, for example, of a sixth form student saying that we need to know the history of the historian in order to understand the version that is being put in front of us. It's quite a highly sophisticated notion.
Well, I liked the way that what happened in the classroom in terms of just discussion regarding Tudor history became something lived in Tony Webster's own life. I mean, Adrian Finn is all he's all the pretentiousness and all the optimism of youth in one way. Mm. And yet there's a very poignant line in a way when we read of how these boys, we're told, were waiting to be released into our lives. And it was a holding pen. So you've got old Joe Hunt and you've got Dixon, their teachers, and they're trying to challenge them. But their lives close down so soon because Adrian Finn dies. And as a result, you've got Tony Webster living 40 years of blank and then returning to that whole past in terms of trying to knit and piece things together to understand.
Do you agree, Julia, that Robson's suicide, he's one of their fellow students, that that's analysed in terms of its implications for historical analysis more than anything else? Do you agree?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Mm. And this is exactly what Adrian Finn is doing. He's talking about the absence of documentation and that Robson leaves a suicide note, which I think says, "Sorry, Mum," and that's it. There's no further explanation.
I mean, you have
given
a deliberate pairing down there. That's a deliberate decision when you realise where he could have gone with the suicide theme. He decides not to. Yeah.
Except that there is another suicide in this,
sure.
You know, but I mean, he asks again and again, he's questioning his memory of things past, etc. And he says, how often do we tell our own life story? How often do we adjust, embellish, make sly cuts? So as a reader, we're aware of this very ordinary man in his 60s trying to understand something that he doesn't quite get. And I thought that was a very interesting dynamic for the reader, the novelist and the character.
Yes.
Well, it's interesting, too, in the sense that it's the women who are telling him in many respects that he just doesn't get it. Veronica, who has been his girlfriend in university, tells him this. And then his ex-wife, Margaret, from whom he's been divorced for 20 years, finally says to him, "You're on your own."
Yeah.
She doesn't want to hear any more about his kind of interest in the former girlfriend.
Well, my favourite moment in the entire novel was a hand gesture, and this is Mrs. Ford, the mother, and we're told that when Tony Webster was leaving after a weekend in Chislehurst in Kent, there was an horizontal gesture at waist level. That's all. And I thought it was a brilliant indication of how things panned out later on, that here was a woman who was interesting and quirky, and she says to Tony, "Oh, don't let Veronica get away with anything." So he was entering into a minefield in a way, and he didn't quite understand what was going on. And there was a mystery. I mean, Veronica is the mystery and Margaret is the clear-edged.
That's right. Did you notice that he gives us a little lexicon of expressions then current, like going out with?
But there is a kind of little potted history of kind of sexuality in the 1960s. And where he makes it very clear that the 60s weren't happening everywhere, and that many places it was still like the 50s. And
there's a lovely story about the male students sleeping with a number of girls to audition them before going out with them.
And his 6 months in America and his meeting up with Annie, though she's only mentioned, gives us a different take on 60s sexuality. But even when Veronica and he were fumbling together in some kind of mechanical sexual scene in Bristol, he wraps up two slices of fruitcake and puts it back in the tin. Those kind of banal little touches were so telling in terms of this limited kind of experience. I mean, he really is a fascinating character in his dullness, I think.
Yeah, I think that's true. But I think his dullness is really being used in a sense that this is... I found the novel interesting because it's, in many respects, it's like a very long, short story rather than a novel, as Niall was saying, because so much of the usual kind of novelistic detail is left out. But on the other hand, it's an essay. And it's an essay about time and memory and history and someone coming to terms in later life with a lived past.
We should say he becomes an arts administrator, our narrator, and there's a divorce after 12 years.
And then he's doing good works in the local library now. He's helping out with in the local hospital, he's helping out as a librarian. But all of those things are just kind of mentioned in passing. We're given so little, so few details about, you know, the 40 years between his early 20s and his late 60s. But I thought it was brilliantly structured, how we get at the beginning six memories and separate memories, and how when we come to them in the book, we can see how these are vital, important moments and how they obviously colour the entire narrative. The Severn boar, the tossing of the frying pan into the sink.
A big turning point is Veronica's mother leaving him Adrian Finn's diary. Adrian has committed suicide.
Well, this is a man who's led a very uneventful life up until this time. And suddenly this letter comes through the door and he discovers that he's been left something in a will. He has to track down who it is. He has to try to get the diary, and in a sense, it re-engages him. It gives him something to do. He becomes involved again with Veronica and also with the whole legal process.
I think that as the narrative unfolds, because as Julia says, the huge interest is for Tony Webster in his 60s, what happens to him and the letter he reads that he once sent to Adrian Finn. I mean, that was a shocking moment in the book. But that whole unravelling of a mystery is somehow compelling. And we're in the dark just as Tony Webster is. And we meet these five people in a North London street and Veronica's there in a fierce rage. What puzzled me is, why was she so angry? Why was this woman so angry? I know she was impatient with Tony, and it's interesting how the modes of communication change as time passes. Letters and cards were once written, now it's email. And when Tony pathetically begins to think he might have some hope again with Veronica or some affection for her, he emails her and he says, "Do you think I was in love with you back then?" Mm. And she replies immediately, "If you need to ask that question, then the answer is no."
No, yes.
But her anger in the closing stages of the novel, what did you think?
It's very difficult to know if she's angry. She certainly is very curt with him.
And she drives like a lunatic.
She does, and very impatient with him. But she remains the mystery woman, as Margaret says.
But tell us again about the copy of the ugly letter that he, Tony, had sent her and Adrian many years ago.
Well, the novel is extremely carefully plotted, and I think that this is one of the most interesting features of it. And the letter, which we heard an extract about it at the beginning of the programme, we finally are given a chance to read the actual letter that was sent. And when we read that, it absolutely revises our opinion of Tony, because he himself is angry, bitter. He's not the dull, cautious, dogged man we had thought that he was. And his rage at Adrian and Veronica and his desire to kind of curse them and to hope that there's revenge for what they've done is very interesting.
It's as if Iago had written it. Mm. It is just a vile, poisonous piece and shocking. But Julia, when you say that, you know, we see then another Tony, we see the angry young man. Did you find that because he didn't carry that anger into his middle years, that it was a little inconsistent?
I didn't actually, no, because I think that he has kind of very carefully sculpted a kind of self-presentation.
Yeah. And for you, this revelation, for you, it makes him more interesting than he'd been up to that point.
Very definitely, yes.
And more unlikable. Yeah.
Yes.
But more passionate. Yeah. You know, that he has been sort of so kind of guarded and unemotional and measured in many ways that this made him more interesting.
And then there are little touches. You know, he allows Margaret to pay the bill at lunch, and then Veronica leaves and she pays her half of the lunch as well. Mm. That there are little touches that suggest that he really is, he is no hero.
She summons him to a meeting at a tube station in North London. And there's a new chapter here where he meets a group of people who are in community care.
Yeah, and Barnes is very clearly preparing for the ending of the novel here. And I would say that I actually found this part of the novel as it develops not entirely credible, and certainly a bit melodramatic as they come upon these characters who are actually like something out of a circus and they're being explained to us. Veronica doesn't provide an explanation. The explanation really only emerges at the very end.
I agree. I think, these are so caricatured and colourful, and they don't really convince. But I thought the three meetings with Veronica, the Wobbly Bridge, the John Lewis and the North London Tube Station, I thought it was an interesting progression in terms of the denouement. But yes, it was very hurried in the end in that you had to sit back and say, my goodness. And then I was disappointed when I read it first because the revelation was just, I couldn't imagine how it came about.
At first he thinks one of them is
Adrian's son. That's his first supposition.
Yes, and then he discovers something else that we shouldn't reveal here because it will spoil it for the reader.
So he's able to work out a whole thing about Adrian, which comes to naught, namely that Adrian couldn't face the fact that he had this child.
And of course, then there's another complication that the gesture at waist level seems to make possible in some strange and interesting way.
I think that Barnes has taken the title of this book from a book by Frank Kermode called The Sense of an Ending. Mm-hmm. And I think in many respects that Barnes is paying homage to Kermode here. And
remind us what Kermode was saying.
Well, I do have a short little quote,
if you
can bear with me. In referring to the sound, well, first of all, what I want to say is that the novel begins with the phrase on the very opening page, tick tock. And this is a phrase that's used by Kermode in the sense of an ending. It's a phrase that guides this text in terms of Kermode's ideas about plot and plotting. In referring to the sound of a clock, not as tick tick, but as tick-tock, we substitute a fiction for the actual acoustic event. Distinguishing between the genesis of tick and the apocalypse of chalk, the fictive end purges the interval of simple chronicity. It achieves a temporal integration that charges it with meaning. So the idea of the tick and the talk and this kind of ending that produces crucial meaning is absolutely central to the text and to the ideas that are being developed in the text as a whole. And the kind of, the lack of credibility in the ending, in a sense, is just an idea that goes back to the beginning, that sends us back to the beginning of the text.
But I do think that the closing words, great unrest,
yes,
that they are credible. And there has been a profound change within Tony Webster in his 60s because of what he's discovered about the past.
Picking up on great unrest, isn't it?
It began in a classroom.
A clumsy response by a young student.
And it means, it's public history and private history.
Yes.
Something happened and great unrest has now become his lived experience as a man.
To that degree, it's a very focused novel, isn't it?
Oh, yes, spare and taut.
The notion of reconstructing a story, historical reconstruction and so on, it's quite focused.
Well, he discovers emotions that he never knew that he had.
Yes.
Particularly, when he first meets Veronica, he starts thinking really in clichés, the eternal hopefulness of the human heart, maybe they'll get back together again, this kind of thing. But what he discovers in the end is remorse.
Yeah. And
this is something
which
he has never known.
We haven't discussed the scene with her family, with Veronica's family. What did you make of that?
Weekend in Kent.
Yes.
Well, Well, I mean, this is when Veronica brings Tony Webster home.
This is the early days.
On show, yeah. So they're both in their early 20s. And there's Jack the brother. There's Mrs. Ford, whose first name we are not even given in that instance. And there's a very cheery hey-ho father, very unlikable as well. But he gives the little guided tour. And there, the most interesting thing about that was Tony Webster realising later on that he doesn't have a lion. But Veronica announced that she and her father and brother would leave and go for a walk so that Tony would get up and have a, well, encounter the mother. And he ponders this as well. That's an intriguing aspect, yes, I think, of the yes. plot.
Well, one, I mean, it's dealing with the idea of people and the degrees of truthfulness, too. You know, and we have the sense all the way through that there's lying going on, that the narrator is lying to us as readers, that perhaps Veronica has lied to her brother and her father about him, and that indeed maybe even that ending might not be truthful.
Yes, yes. So, it's well set up, that early scene with the family, isn't it?
Very yes. well set. Very, yeah. very well set up. And it's interesting, too, in terms of kind of the whole kind of subject of class, and that Tony feels himself to be in a kind of lower social position in relation to this family. And he has a certain amount of class anxiety with regard to that, in exactly the same way as he has kind of anxiety about Adrian's intellectual superiority. So when Adrian and Veronica get together, he feels doubly wounded, let's say.
Yes. What about her brother? She has a brother, doesn't she, who's at Cambridge?
Yes.
Jack is reading moral sciences in Cambridge as well, and there are emails from him later on in life, and they're just kind of so... so mannered, so self-important in a way.
But there's the sense, too, that Jack might be lying, too. In Jack's emails, he's always saying, oh, my rickshaw is coming. And Tony's saying that, oh, he's in Singapore and his rickshaw is coming. But Tony thinks, well, maybe that's not true at all. You know, maybe he's just at some internet cafe because he's staying in a hotel that since he's lost his job and all these kinds of things. So the truthfulness of everyone. Yeah. Seriously,
the
being
narrator here asks explicitly, does character develop over time? And you're suggesting that, in fact, Julia, that he does.
Well, yeah. one of the questions in the novel, I mean, the novel sets up this contrast between fiction and life. And the boys are told early on by their English teacher that character develops over time in the novel. And then the question remains as to whether or not the character develops over time in the figure of Tony. But certainly it's a question raised in the novel.
And there's also the observation that, you know, life isn't all it's cracked up to be, but there's an accumulation and a multiplication of loss and failure.
Yes.
So that this is the trajectory of Tony Webster's life, really.
Yes, that the context there is that Adrian has been asking the question that in the diary, to what extent might human relationships be expressed in a mathematical formula?
Yes.
That's a very young question to ask, isn't it?
But the idea of accumulation and indeed responsibility is an interesting one. And this is one that Tony struggles to come to terms with, in a sense, in the end. About whether or not he himself has been responsible for everything that has happened to the others around him.
But I suppose the key theme is that of historical reconstruction. I mean, there's one very good line where he says, diary is evidence. It might disrupt the banal reiterations of memory. It's quite a good line.
It is. Oh, I mean, there are some wonderfully kind of interesting observations. And even though Tony Webster, as Julia reminded us, can be given to banalities, like as the poet says. There are wonderful observations as well. For example, one of the very opening page, we live in time, it holds us and moulds us. I mean, our relationship with time and with memory and the person whom we become. The Book of Judges hailed this as a masterpiece. I see it as a kind of a masterpiece, you know, because of the world of the book, and it's small, and yet Julian Barnes, I think, is doing a wonderful job at recreating a very ordinary man caught up in a situation that's complex and the ground is shifting under him.
Yes, I think that idea of the ground shifting under him, and particularly the Severn Moor image of the water, the illusion, I think it is, of the water reversing and of nature reversed and time with it. And this sense of the way in which time is perceived in youth and then in later life is very interesting in the novel as a whole.
We've been discussing The Sense of an Ending by Julian Barnes, published by Jonathan Cape. My thanks to Niall McMonagall and Julia Carson. You can listen to the programme again on our off-the-shelf website at rte.ie. Till next week, bye-bye.